Good evening, everyone. Joa's cat, the two cats, sit with us usually when we sit there on Monday nights at his house. One sits with us and the other one comes into the interview room. I don't know which one this is now. It's the small one?
Yeah, the small one.
Yeah.
The interview cat.
Right, the interview cat. So, yeah. So it feels like we're there almost. I really enjoy that 10-minute sitting period. It's like I just can not think about anything and think about everything or something. Just open up, open wide and let come what come and just sit here in the middle of it. I love it. I think particularly today I was busy. I had things to do today and I had interviews this morning with people, which I love as well. And knew that I had to give a talk tonight. And also tomorrow morning, I'm being interviewed on radio. And I don't really know what I'm supposed to say or what we're supposed to talk about. Apart from, she said, Zen, my path. But it's when someone says something like that to me, I don't know what to say. And so I've been preoccupied with that today too. Thinking, should I prepare something? Should I review something? Should I think about it? Or should I just wait and see what happens? So I was kind of had that same attitude tonight. About seeing what happens. And those 10 minutes are great for that. I was recently, I've been reading different, this ongoing book that it's taking forever to read that I've mentioned before by French philosopher Michel Serre. And something, a really interesting point he made in terms of Christian tradition, that two of the greatest prophets of the Christian tradition, Jesus and Francis of Assisi, were out and didn't have a fixed home. You know, they were like what we would call SDF today. They were homeless, and they wandered around the countryside, which the Buddha also did. And were very, lived in a very simple, poor way, vows of poverty and just receiving what was given to them and eating that or using, not worrying about fancy clothing. You know, Francis very dramatically, his father was a merchant who traded in luxurious fabrics, silk and brocade and things. And he very famously gave all that up. and appeared naked in the town square and humiliated his father, embarrassed his father, and left the town. And so Michel Serres points in his view, the city is related to churches and power and doctrines and constructions, and the countryside, the wild, is related with mysticism, abandoning fixed ideas, responding to whatever the situation is, settling wherever it's appropriate and working with what's there. And then Michel Serres extends this to a notion of global and local. And he associates the city and the church and the seat of power and the doctrines with local. And he associates the mysticism and the countryside and the wild with global, which for me was interesting because I don't normally think in those terms. So I've been trying to see what that brings up for me and then for us in terms of our practice. And I tend to identify much more with Jesus and Francis of Assisi than with, say, you know, the ones who built the church, Paul and Peter and the others. And the amusing story about Francis is that he was in the countryside or he was in a local chapel that was kind of falling into ruin. It was not in good state. And he had a meeting with God. He heard the voice of God telling him that he should repair it, that the church needed help and that he needed to take care of it and repair it. And he took this, at first he took this literally. And he went about raising money and, you know, selling some of his father's great, beautiful, luxurious products and so that he could fix this church, this chapel that he was in when he heard that call. And it was only much later that he realized that that was not what the call was, that the call was a bigger call to not literally fix that church, you know, the bricks and the wood and the stone, but to heal the church, which the greater church, the institution, which at the time was losing sight from its message of Christ's basic message of love and becoming attached to doctrines and fancy priests and hierarchies and following rules and things like that. But so Francis had to go through that initial following the rules, becoming a part of the church, going to Rome, to the Vatican. He had to go through all of that before he could get to this realization in his heart of what was intended, what is really meant to heal and see the church for what it truly was. In any case, for us, it's the same thing. You know, we have all these rituals and rules and regulations and structures, and we've talked about this endlessly. And it would seem, in my experience, that the rituals are a necessity for our spiritual calling. Not any one ritual in particular, but just as a um, as a way, as I often say, of communing with the impersonal universe through the ritual, gaining access to that the global mysticism that I think that Michel Serre, if I put my words, it would be the impersonal mysticism instead of the personal business, city, churches, rules, regulations, and all of that. And if we become caught up in someone was telling me today that she was going to sit at the Dojo Zen in Lisbon, which is run by the Deshimaru Sangha. And because she sits in a chair, she doesn't sit on a cushion. She has to sit outside in the hallway. She can't sit in Zendo with all the others. But she loves to sit there. She loves to go there, even if she's sitting alone in the hallway outside of the Zendo. And she said her koan was, we were talking about inside and outside. And she said, okay, I'm going there now and I will look at that. I'll look at the no inside, no outside. And I said, what's interesting is where you're going. And they think very clearly that there's an inside and an outside. You have to be outside because you can only be inside if you sit like they do. And yet you are going there to meditate on there's no inside and outside. I have no idea if those other practitioners there are thinking of it in terms of inside and outside, but clearly there's a separation that's being made. That if you don't sit a certain way, you can't sit at all. At least with us. If you want to sit a different way, you can sit, but in the hallway. So I'll be curious to know what her meditation was today, having been sitting outside, meditating on no inside, no outside. And the whole, that applies for all dualities. So if we're thinking in terms of black and white, come back to our racial issues, we need to acknowledge the differences. And yet, if we focus only on those differences, then we will be having trouble. And we will not commune with that interpersonal, that impersonal, universal, mysticism, if you will. I say mysticism only in because it's mysterious, not because it's some new age thing, right? It's just that the countryside in this schema of Michel Serre represents what the mystery of life. Whereas in the city, it's all very clear. The streets are marked, the buildings are very clearly constructed, there's an order that's established. In the churches, there's very little mystery anymore. It's all very clearly established. And in some Buddhist churches as well. So, and in a greater sense, all of this, what I'm saying, all it does is it helps us to open our minds, to widen our perspective, to look into, to question, to say, well, what is the mystery right now? What's mysterious right now? What is it that I don't see? What is it that I can't see? During the confinement at the beginning, before I became sick, At 8 o'clock every night, we would open the windows and clap for the healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, whatever. People were doing this all over the world, right? It wasn't just Paris. And I could see some of the people. There weren't very many leaves on the trees at that time in early March. And so the neighbors across the way I could see. And it was dark. So their light would be on in their living room and they were backlit. But that was it. I couldn't see anyone on my side of the street, but I could hear them. I could hear the clapping. And it was as if it was just clapping. It wasn't individual people. It was like a chorus of united hands clapping. At one point in the reflection of a window across the street, I could see my neighbors, Michel Dubois, at the his kitchen window with a pot and a spoon pounding. But I could only see him in reflection, and anyone else on my side of the street I couldn't see. And there was, that was an experience of this impersonal resonance of being. It was impossible to hear just two hands clapping. It was all the hands clapping as one. And it was a ritual. No one would have done that if there wasn't this ritual. And it was as if we almost needed that ritual in our lives. People really needed that 8 o'clock. I mean, some people didn't do it. But, and just a generalization, people needed that ritual to meet at that time together and just clap for however long. Then when I became sick, I didn't do it anymore because I was in my bed at that time. And if I did it, I suppose I could have done it upstairs in my room, but it didn't really make much sense. Didn't speak to me anymore. And then when I was no longer sick and I was up well enough to come down and do it again, the trees had filled out. Spring was in full bloom. I could almost not see the people across the street anymore because they were blocked by the trees. And it was light outside at 8 o'clock. So there weren't any more reflections visible. There were no lights lighting up people in their living rooms. So I couldn't see them, but I could still hear them. And so that ritual still had the meaning. There was still that shared coming together of letting go of our individual, am I clapping well? Am I clapping louder than you? Am I being heard? It was the same, still the same chorus of an impersonal coming together, a coming together of the impersonal, say. And if you look around in your daily lives, there's so many rituals like this that we all share. And maybe we don't participate in all of them. You know, some people have a ritual of turning on the news at a specific time and listening to it. And there are millions of people doing exactly that same thing at the same time. We all have the ritual, if we go in public transport, we put on a mask. We have the ritual if we go into a shop. I don't know how it is in the UK and Portugal, but in France, generally, if you go into a shop, you're supposed to put on a mask. Although some people I've noticed aren't doing it. People have rituals of walking their dogs. You have a ritual of feeding your cats. You have a ritual of brushing your teeth. And there's something when you just give yourself to that ritual entirely, without thinking, am I doing this well? Is anyone watching me do this? Will people approve of it? Will I be doing it better than other people? I don't really like doing this, so I'm just getting it out of the way. Sometimes brushing teeth is like that, you know? If we try not to be caught by those thoughts, if we just brush our teeth, a glimpse of the impersonal is there. If we just take out the bag of trash, of garbage, if we just clean the toilet, I cleaned my bathroom yesterday, so that's present. So, not something I particularly like to do, but it has to be done, right? So, and it actually was a great experience because I wasn't thinking about how much I don't like it. And I wasn't thinking about how I wanted to be doing something else. I just really was doing it. And it was a great experience. So brushing teeth, taking out the trash, cleaning the toilets, the bathroom, those are, we're not in a group with others doing it, but we are, you know, joining with every person who cleans toilets all the time, you know, or everyone who takes their bag of garbage out. And in the metro, when you put on your mask, you're joining with all the others who are putting on their mask. We're all doing it together. And what's beautiful about that particular one is we're doing it together for each other. We're not doing it for ourselves because the mask is not to protect us, it's to protect the others. And everybody has different masks. Everyone wears them differently. Everyone has a different size face. And yet, we're all one doing it. So, yeah, I don't really think I have much else to say. It would be nice to hear if you have anything to say, to join the river of voices, the universal impersonal river of voices.
I was talking to someone today, and it always strikes me how there's always it's always a fine line how with the form at the same time it gives us the possibility to experience the impersonal, and there's a fine line where suddenly we get stuck with that particular form. And so the form reveals also the relationship that we have with the form. I mean, the experience of the rituals reveals our relationship with a form and whether or not we get attached to it also. And so we can get attached to, paradoxically, we can get attached to the impersonal form that is given to us, and then it becomes very personal.
Yeah. Like what? Do you have an example?
Well, I mean, we've always experienced in retreats people who think that it's all about the form and that they know the form, that know the, instead of getting the spirit of it and of the impersonal, I think I know how that works. And that's how it should be.
Yeah.
And I think I've probably seen it. I have seen that happening all over and over again over the years. Especially, and the funny thing is when you go to a different sangha that kind of do things slightly differently, and suddenly you're very puzzled, and it's very easy to fall into the, why do they do this this way? Instead of, oh, how interesting that they do that this way. So it's very easy to see how the mind gets stuck into habitual form.
Well, and that is exactly how the churches get built. You know, and doctrines get constructed, is because people become fixed on a form, you know. And forget that it's not about that, and it's not, you know, people kill each other about form.
And the words also, I find that the words are also interesting. You know, it conveys a certain meaning, and then we get stuck with one particular translation. We get stuck with a way to say things, and it becomes lifeless suddenly. Also, for the words. So it's nice. I find it really nice to see how we can refresh that, and make it alive again.
Yeah, and what you were saying about the voices and the clapping and everything, this comes at different times, chanting sutras. In the beginning, chanting sutras, it was like I was on drugs. I love to sing, and I don't sing very well, so singing with other people, I get the impression I'm a good singer, so I'm being a good singer, and I love the singing, and I love the sutras. And then recently, well, in the last couple of years, I realized that if I didn't sing quite so loud, I might be able to hear everybody else. And then there's a whole other register of people not singing very loud. I mean, it's really fascinating. I can do it all, you know, you could go on for hours. If you go real loud, there are the loud people. And then if you get soft, there are the soft people. If you just lip sync, then you can hear everybody. No, it's a very revealing. There's something revealing about it, being one in many, or maybe it's just that it really speaks to me because I love music and singing. But it's being one in many in that particular experience is very manifest to me.
Speaking on form, I'd like to say that I like the new look of Amy.
Cut off.
I don't know if
I didn't hear it.
Can you hear me? I don't know. I don't know if you can hear me. This is, I think this the internet is stopped.
No, we can hear you. I think it's Amy who got cut off.
Oh, really? Okay. I'm the only one? Okay. So
I could hear it wrong. Yeah.
I didn't hear it, Alberto.
You can hear?
Say it again.
I'm saying that we are speaking of form, and I'm saying that I like you. I like your new look.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I had my hair cut today. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you hear?
Yeah.
Yeah. On the subject of forms, it's just referring to what Joe was saying, and what surprised me when I went to Japan and went for a couple of days in a Zen temple, and how it seems to be all about forms. And it's very, very, very precise, very precise. And the way they chant sutras are super fast, super fast. And the whole ceremony of bowing and folding and unfolding this white thing that you have to kneel on, and they had exercise sessions that were very also formal and timed and very fast, and I found it very interesting and surprising and so different from what we do, and wondering, well, what you're wondering, I mean, thinking two things. One is, I can imagine how once you're in that rhythm and these forms, yeah, it's no longer about you. It's just this, or you just do it and you're just part of this whole big group. But at the same time, I can imagine being caught in the form and it being just about this, just about the form. And you often speak about, you know, freedom. And I just wonder how you find it in such a strict, in a way, form. I was just, yeah.
I guess the notion of strict or not strict is, those are relative terms.
Cultural, yeah, and very cultural, probably.
Yeah. Mm. And so some people find our forms in our retreats and our sitting groups very strict. Others find it very lax. So it's all relative. And the freedom comes from just letting go and allow and being the form, being what is, and doing it fully. So am I the only one who's having trouble with internet here? Can you hear me?
Yes, but
yeah, everyone else's images are frozen.
Yes,
if you put yourself, if you turn off your video, sometimes it helps.
You mean then people's faces will start moving again?
Might.
Yeah, you have been moving slowly, but Joa, Debbie, Alberto were frozen. So anyway, this is also, we just deal with the form. We just respond to this form. you know, and whatever it is. And if we were fixed on, it has to work a certain way, it has to be a certain way, well, we wouldn't even be sitting here right now, you know. But I don't think that the freedom, in my experience, the freedom doesn't come from the particular form. It becomes to our, from our relationship with it. So, I was trained in a much stricter way than I practice now. I mean, stricter in terms of, I think I am as rigorous with the practice, but I'm not interested in the same kinds of forms. They don't apply to the people I practice with. You know, it just doesn't make sense in the same way. And the challenge is, we have these discussions with my Dharma brothers and sisters who are also teachers, and who did live, we did live with our teacher. And we did live in a very rigorous formal practice, and we wore robes, and you know, we did the whole thing. And so the question is, well, how can we, I don't really have the question so much anymore, but I did at a time, and I know some of my Dharma brothers and sisters still have it. So how can we, it's a bit like your question, Lisa, so how can we provide for our students a form that allows them to awaken and gives them the experience of rigor without it being like the form that we had, because we cannot, none of us can do that. None of us can live with students. None of us have students who even would want to live with us. I mean, really, you know, I'm sure if by some miracle, you know, I had a place where some people could live, I think there would be a few people who would do it, even short term, you know, even if it was not for their lifelong home, but that they would do it. But that's just not the reality. And so the challenge is, well, then what do we do? How do we, instead of seeking to walk in the footsteps of the wise, we seek what they sought. To stay with that Zen phrase saying, you know. And that's always what I've tried to do, is seek what they sought and try to help my students seek what I sought. Seek what I seek. And it doesn't depend on any form. Actually, it's just seek. Just seek. Not seek what I sought, but seek.
Qu'est-ce que c'est seek?
Chercher. I don't know, in Portuguese, how would you say it?
Procurar.
Procurar. Procurar.
Procurar. Yeah, thinking about form, I bring to us a little decoration from my day.
Nice.
There are navettes.
Navette. Yeah. Nice.
Form. It's my form. My decoration.
Nice. And what will you do with those navettes?
To make a cook.
Mm-hmm. For you or to sell in the market?
No, to me. I buy the, I was in the market and okay. I buy things for me. And it was a little decoration for us when I arrived.
Nice. Well, we're almost out of time, so maybe we should stop. Thank you. And I guess we will be back here next Thursday night, and the same sitting periods continue.
Have a nice interview tomorrow.
Ah, thank you. There will be a link to the podcast. I will send it out once I get it done. It will be in French.
Yeah, but enjoy it.
Ah, thank you. That's good. I need to hear that.